Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, by Carol Quigley. The Turning Tide, 1942 to 1943. Midway, El Alamein, French Africa, and Stalingrad. The Second World War was a gigantic conflict because it was an agglomeration of several wars. Each of these wars had a different turning point, but all of these occurred in the year following the surrender of Corridor on May 6, 1942. The first turning point to be reached in the war between the United States and Japan occurred at Midway on June 4, 1942, while the second was reached in the defeat of the Italo-German attack on Egypt on November 2, 1942. The American War on Germany took a turn for the better with the successful American invasion of French North Africa on November 8, 1942. While at the same time, the crucial struggle between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union reached its turn in the long agony at Stalingrad from November 1942 to February 1943. Needless to say, long and bitter exertions were needed to push the three aggressor states back from their points of furthest advance. The Battle of Midway arose from a Japanese trap, which was supposed to destroy the rest of the Pacific Fleet, but resulted quite differently. Whatever illusions the Japanese Army may have had, the Japanese Navy fully recognized that it could not possibly win in the Pacific until the American fleet was totally destroyed. To achieve this, a trap was set to draw the fleet out from Pearl Harbor by the threat of a Japanese amphibious invasion of Midway Island from the southwest. When the Americans hurried out to attack this invasion fleet at Midway, they were to have been destroyed by the planes from four Japanese carriers lying in ambush 200 miles northwest of Midway. The ambush was reversed because Admiral Chester Nimitz at Pearl Harbor had a clear picture of the Japanese plans and sent his own carriers out to spring on the Japanese carriers from a point 200 miles northeast of their position. The American counter-ambush worked because of a most extraordinary series of fortunate chances. The four Japanese carriers expected the American counterattack to come from Pearl Harbor after several days' delay, and accordingly felt free to use their own carrier planes to bombard the Midway defenses, softening them up for the benefit of the invading force coming up on Midway from the southwest. These bombardment planes had returned from Midway to their carriers and were still feverishly refueling on the flight decks when the American carrier Strike came in. 116 planes from Enterprise and Hornet were followed shortly after by 35 planes from Yorktown. Caught in a horrible tactical position, the Japanese defended so skillfully that 37 out of 41 American torpedo bombers were lost. But as wave after wave of dive bombers continued to come in, the Japanese defense was saturated, and soon all four carriers were sinking in flames. Before the fourth Japanese carrier went down, it sent off 40 planes which torpedoed the Yorktown. The American carrier was incapacitated and mistakenly abandoned, so that it was easily sunk by a Japanese submarine 2 days later. This loss, even in combination with the loss of the Lexington in the Coral Sea a month earlier, was a cheap price to pay for the destruction of five Japanese carriers in these two areas in the space of 5 weeks, since the United States had the industrial capacity to replace its losses, while Japan did not. Two events of November 1942, the British victory at El Alamein and the Anglo-American invasion of French North Africa, provided tactical lessons and strategic reversals fully as great as those provided in the Pacific 5 months earlier. During most of 1942, the British clung to their lifeline across the Mediterranean from Gibraltar to Malta and Egypt by no more than a fingernail's margin. Italo-German submarine and air attacks were steadily intensified, while the whole northern shore of the Mediterranean, from Gibraltar to the Aegean, was under Axis control or sympathetic to it. The Italian foothold on the southern shore of the Mediterranean in Libya was steadily strengthened, largely by German reinforcements, and German pressure was brought to bear on Vichy France to increase Nazi influence in French North Africa. As long as the British were opposed only by Italian forces in the Mediterranean, they were able to keep convoys moving. But on January 10, 1941, the German Air Force intervened in the central Mediterranean with devastating effect. From that point onward, for a period of 2 years, until May 1943, it was impossible to get a merchant convoy through the Mediterranean from Gibraltar to Alexandria. Accordingly, the British Imperial forces in Egypt had to be supplied by the longer route around Africa. Even British naval vessels found it difficult to pass through the Mediterranean. In the course of 1941, all the British capital ships and carriers in the central and eastern Mediterranean were sunk or damaged so badly that they had to be withdrawn. The island of Malta, situated in the middle of the Axis supply line from Italy to Africa, was pulverized from the air for more than 19 months until October 1942, and all vessels, even submarines, had to be withdrawn from its harbors. Efforts to replenish its supplies of food and ammunition became suicidal, but had to be continued, as its civilian population stood up magnificently under the pounding and could not be left without supplies by the fighting services. For months at a time, no convoys could get through, but each time supplies approached exhaustion, fragments of a convoy arrived with enough to keep the island fighting a little longer. In June 1941, 10 merchant ships from Alexandria and 6 from Gibraltar were sent simultaneously in order to divide the enemy. Although protected by a battleship, 2 carriers, 12 cruisers, and 44 destroyers, only 2 of the 16 cargo vessels arrived at Malta, at a cost of 3 destroyers and a cruiser sunk and many others damaged. 2 months later, when Malta had only a week's supplies left, 14 very fast merchant vessels were sent from Gibraltar with an escort of 2 battleships, 4 carriers, 7 cruisers, and 25 destroyers. 5 badly damaged merchant ships reached Malta with a naval loss of a carrier, 2 cruisers, and a destroyer sunk. Another carrier and 2 cruisers badly damaged. This severe fighting in the central Mediterranean arose from the vital need by both sides to control the communications of that area. The northern shore of the Mediterranean Sea, from west to east, was controlled by Franco-Spain, by Vichy France, by the Axis, and by Turkey. Spain was pro-Axis, but unable, through economic weakness, to intervene in the war until Britain was thoroughly beaten. Vichy France remained ambiguous and a major leak in the economic blockade of Europe until November 1942. Turkey was pro-British, but unable to offer anything more than benevolent neutrality. On the southern shore of the Mediterranean, Libya, consisting of Tripolitania in the west and Cyrenaica in the east, was in between Egypt and French North Africa, and could be used as a base to attack either because of the Axis supply lines from Italy and Sicily. These lines were greatly strengthened by the Axis conquest of Greece and Crete in May and June 1941. From this base in Libya, the Axis struck at Egypt 3 times and were answered by 3 British counterattacks. These provided the historian with an amazing sequence of movements in which the battle lines surged across Africa between Egypt and French Tunis, a distance of 1,200 miles. The real struggle was for control of Cyrenaica, and especially for its seaports strung like beads from Benghazi eastward, 270 miles, by way of Derna and Tobruk to Sulum on the Egyptian frontier. If the Germans could control this stretch, they could use Tobruk as a supply port, free from interference from Malta. While if the British could control it, they could provide air cover from Malta from African fields. The first Axis advance by the Italians under Graziani went no farther than Sidi Barani in Egypt, 50 miles east of Sulum, September 1940. This was repulsed by an amazing British advance of 500 miles from Sidi Barani to El Agahiela, 150 miles beyond Benghazi, December 1940 through February 1941. It was to stop this Italian retreat, early in 1941, that the Nazis intervened with an air fleet of 500 planes under Kesselring and the famous Afrika Korps under Field Marshal Erwin Rommel. Rommel, a tactical genius, had three German divisions, two armored and one motorized, supported by seven Italian divisions, six infantry and one armored. By a series of smashing blows, Rommel advanced eastward to Egypt, destroying most of the British armor on the way. But his advance stopped at Sulum in April 1941. Hitler held up most of the supplies going to Rommel because he needed them in Greece, Crete, and later in Russia. The supply routes to Rommel were very precarious because of British naval attacks out of Alexandria, only 250 miles to the east, and because of an Australian division left in Tobruk that, although supported by Rommel and besieged for months, denied him the use of its port. While Rommel's supplies were dwindling and the British Navy was being driven from the central Mediterranean by Axis air power and submarines, the defense of Egypt was being built up by the Circum-Africa supply line. Over this 10,000-mile route came 951 light tanks and 13,000 trucks, many of these under lend-lease, by the end of 1941. With this equipment, General Claude Auchinleck attacked Rommel in November 1941, and in 2 months relieved Tobruk and forced the Germans back to El Agahiela, January 1942. Within a week, Rommel counterattacked and advanced eastward, being stopped 40 miles west of Tobruk, mid-February 1942. Both sides rested there, while the Western powers feverishly built up their supplies in Egypt. At the end of May 1942, Rommel struck again. This time he captured Tobruk and was finally stopped at El Alamein, only 60 miles short of Alexandria. After 5 days of furious fighting at that point, July 1st through the 5th, 1942. In August, General Bernard L. Montgomery, later Field Marshal and First Viscount Montgomery of Alamein, replaced General Auchinleck. His forces were equipped with every piece of armament that could be spared from the United States, including 700 two-engine bombers, 1,000 fighting planes, over 400 M4 Sherman tanks, 90 new American self-propelled guns, and 25,000 trucks and other vehicles. On October 23rd, while Rommel was absent in Germany, Montgomery attacked the Axis forces at their strongest point along the coast road, and after 12 days of violent combat broke through the German position. Rommel returned, but could not stop the rout. By November 20th, he had lost Benghazi and was still retreating. Worse than that, on November 8th, only 4 days after El Alamein, Rommel heard that a large-scale American invasion of French North Africa had already landed at Three Points. These had to be hurled backward, for the German forces could be cut off if the Americans passed Tunis. The American invasion of North Africa on November 8, 1942, Operation Torch, arose as a compromise of quite dissimilar strategic ideas in Moscow, London, and Washington. Stalin was insistent that the Anglo-Americans must open a second front in Western Europe in 1942 in order to reduce the Nazi pressure on Russia. He was completely unreasonable in his attitude, going so far as to taunt Churchill with cowardice at the Moscow Conference in August 1942. In London, there was indeed great lack of faith in any possible invasion of Europe. Instead, there was hope that the Germans could be brought to terms by air attacks and economic blockade after perhaps 10 years. Churchill went a little further by speaking of a possible invasion of the continent from the Mediterranean through what he mistakenly called the soft underbelly of the Axis. In Washington, the military leaders were convinced from the earliest stages of the war that Hitler could not be beaten without a full-scale invasion of Western Europe. As early as April 1942, Harry Hopkins and General Marshall appeared in London with plans for an invasion of Western Europe by 30 American and 18 British divisions. The British were very reluctant, but as Stalin kept insisting on a second front in 1942, Roosevelt on July 25th obtained, as a compromise, an agreement to invade French North Africa in the autumn of 1942. There was hardly time for adequate planning and no time for adequate training before the landings were made on November 8th. Although the operation was a joint British-American venture, the British role was little publicized to avoid antagonizing French, especially French naval, feelings, which were still hostile because of the British attacks on Dakar, Oran, and Syria. In addition, a difficult problem arose about the question of political cooperation with the French authorities in North Africa. The British had placed most of their faith in General de Gaulle, but it soon became clear that he had very little support in North Africa and was too difficult and uncooperative personally to be made part of the invasion plans. The Americans, who had maintained diplomatic relations with Vichy, believed it would be necessary to replace the local Vichy leaders as soon as North Africa had been conquered. They pinned their faith on the heroic General Henri Gérard, who had obtained considerable publicity by his spectacular escapes from German prisons in both world wars. Unfortunately, as the invasion proceeded, it was discovered that Gérard had even less influence in North Africa than de Gaulle, especially in the French Navy, which was providing the chief combat resistance to the invasion. Accordingly, in order to stop the fighting, it became necessary to make a deal with Admiral Darlan, who was in North Africa at the time. This deal, which recognized Darlan as the chief political authority in all French North Africa, with Gérard as his commander-in-chief, has given rise to much controversy. It was argued that the high principles enunciated in our declared war aims, especially in the Atlantic Charter, were being unnecessarily sacrificed by making a deal with an unprincipled Nazi collaborator such as Darlan. The deal was justified by its makers. General Mark Clark, on behalf of General Eisenhower, and Ambassador Robert Murphy, on behalf of President Roosevelt, on grounds of military urgency. This argument is rather weak, since Darlan's ceasefire order made at noon on November 8th was not obeyed in two combat areas, Morocco and Oran, and obeyed only partially in the third area, Algiers. And by the time the formal deal was made on November 11th, organized fighting by the French forces had ceased everywhere. The additional justification made to the effect that some kind of legal continuity with the Vichy regime had to be established to avoid French guerrilla resistance involves too many unknown factors to permit any convincing judgment of its value. It seems weak, since the German reaction to the Allied invasion of North Africa took an anti-French direction, which was so drastic that any French resistance to the Americans or British would have been clearly pro-German, and thus most unlikely behavior for any patriotic Frenchman. In any case, the Darlan deal was soon swallowed up in the swift pace of events, and was personally ended when Darlan was assassinated by his French enemies on December 24th. The Anglo-American invasion of North Africa, known as Operation Torch, and under the overall command of General Eisenhower, involved landings at three points, and on the Atlantic coast of Morocco, near Casablanca, by a force coming from North America, and at two points on the Mediterranean coast, in Algeria, by forces coming from England. The Morocco attack was almost foolhardy, since it involved carrying 35,000 completely inexperienced and inadequately trained troops with 250 tanks, all in 102 vessels, a distance of 4,000 miles across the ocean to make a night landing on a hostile coast. In spite of these obstacles and tenacious French resistance at certain points, the operation was a success, and fighting ceased in 3 days. The other portion of Operation Torch, the landings in Algeria, were on a larger scale, since they involved 49,000 American and 23,000 British troops, and were equally successful. By November 14th, the Allies were moving eastward into Tunisia to cut off Rommel's retreat from the east, and by November 29th, they were only 12 miles from Tunis. From that point, they were hurled backward by the Germans. Hitler's reactions to Torch were vigorous. All France was occupied by Nazi forces. His efforts to capture the French fleet at Toulon were frustrated when most of the vessels were scuttled at their anchorages or were sunk trying to escape from the harbors. As early as November 10th, German airborne troops, with Laval's blessings, were occupying Tunisia. These German forces held up the Allied advance from the west, inflicting a bitter defeat on the American forces at the Kasserine Pass in February 1943. In this way, Rommel, who had been forced out of El Agahiela by Montgomery on December 13th, was able to withdraw westward into Tunisia and take a stand along the Marith line below Gabes in southeastern Tunisia in February. During the third week in January 1943, Roosevelt, Churchill, and their staffs met in secret conference at Casablanca. Once again, the Americans had to struggle against English reluctance to commit themselves to any cross-channel invasion of Europe, to any offensive against Japan, or indeed to any long-range planning. From the compromises of the conference emerged agreement to postpone any cross-channel operation, to keep up pressure on Germany and Europe by air attacks, and to allow the United States to take any offensive actions against Japan, which would not jeopardize the priority still given to the defeat of Germany. Two other decisions were to proceed to the military occupation of Sicily, and to demand the unconditional surrender of the three totalitarian powers. Naturally, the military decision on Sicily was kept secret, but the political decision on unconditional surrender was published with great fanfare and at once initiated a controversy which still continues. The controversy over unconditional surrender is based on the belief that the expression itself is largely meaningless and had an adverse influence by discouraging any hopes within the Axis countries that they could find a way out by slackening their efforts, by revolting against their governments, or by negotiations seeking some kind of conditional surrender. There seems to be little doubt that the demand for unconditional surrender was incompatible with earlier statements that we were fighting the German, Japanese, and Italian governments rather than the German, Japanese, and Italian peoples, and that this demand, by destroying this distinction, to some extent solidified our enemies and prolonged their resistance, especially in Italy and Japan, where opposition to the war was widespread and active. Even in Germany, the demand for unconditional surrender discouraged those more moderate and peace-loving Germans, upon which our post-war policy toward Germany must be based, and, in fact, has been based. But in 1943, and for most of the duration of the war, the Allied powers had neither time nor inclination to look ahead toward any post-war policy with respect to Germany, and issued the demand for unconditional surrender without any analysis of its possible effects on the enemy peoples, either during the war or after it was over. The demand for unconditional surrender was made, rather, as a morale booster for the Allied powers themselves, and in this function, it may well have had some slight influence at the time. As the Allied leaders were conferring in Casablanca after turning back the German assault in Africa, Soviet forces were inflicting an even greater defeat on Hitler in Eastern Europe. Hitler's Russian campaign of 1942 was very similar to that of 1941, except that his original plan was restricted to a single aim: to capture the oil fields of the Caucasus. The German forces, consisting of 44 infantry and 10 armored and 6 motorized divisions, along with 43 satellite divisions and 700 planes, were to drive along the north shore of the Black Sea, pass through a congested bottleneck at Rostov, and capture the Soviet oil fields, the chief of which, at Baku, was 700 miles beyond Rostov. To protect the long northern flank of this drive, other German attacks were ordered farther north, toward Voronezh and toward Stalingrad, on the Volga River. The German offensive did reach the Caucasus, advancing almost as far as Grozny, 400 miles beyond Rostov, but did not capture the chief oil fields. As in the 1941 offensive, scores of Soviet divisions were destroyed, and hundreds of thousands of Soviet prisoners were captured, but no vital injury was inflicted on the Soviet Union. Suddenly, on July 18th, after 7 weeks of advance, Hitler ordered the capture of Stalingrad. Since all the available armored forces had been put into the Caucasus offensive, where they uselessly clogged up Rostov, the attack on Stalingrad could not begin until September 12. After 2 months of savage house-to-house fighting, the Germans had possession of almost all the city, but it had been completely demolished. In late November, Russian counteroffensives north and south of Stalingrad broke through Romanian armies on either side of the German 6th Army and joined together on its rear. Hitler forbade any retreat or any effort by the 6th Army to fight its way westward, out of the trap. Instead, he undertook to supply the 6th Army from the air until new German forces could break in to relieve it. The surrounded 6th Army consisted of 20 divisions, about 270,000 men, including 3 armored and 3 motorized divisions. Although a force of this size required about 1,500 tons of supplies each day, the Luftwaffe was never able to deliver as much as 200 tons a day, and lost about 300 planes in the effort. Nor could the German forces to the west, although only 40 miles away, fight their way in to the 6th Army. While this was going on at Stalingrad from December 1942 through January 1943, another Soviet offensive, striking down from the northeast toward Rostov, was trying to cut off the whole German force in the Caucasus by capturing the city of Rostov and thus closing the bottleneck north of the Sea of Azov. The German withdrawal from the Caucasus began on the first day of 1943. With extraordinary skill, the Germans succeeded in keeping the Rostov passage open, although by January 23rd, it was no more than 30 miles wide. The German 6th Army at Stalingrad, although frozen, starved, and hardly able to fight for lack of supplies, was not permitted to surrender, because, as soon as it did so, the three Soviet armies which had surrounded it would be freed to drive west and close the Rostov passage. On January 23rd, General Friedrich von Paulus, commanding the 6th Army, accepted Hitler's radio order to fight to the last man in order to gain time. A week later, Hitler promoted him to Field Marshal, and 2 days later he surrendered. Of 270,000 Germans originally surrounded, over 100,000 were dead, 34,000 had been evacuated by air, and 93,000 surrendered. 10 days after Paulus surrendered, the Germans abandoned Rostov. For the next 2 weeks, it looked as if a new Soviet offensive from Voronezh might cut off the whole of German Army Group South. But Field Marshal von Manstein succeeded in reestablishing a stable defensive line by April 1st, just about at the line where the German offensive of 1942 had begun 11 months earlier. But in that 11 months, Hitler had lost about 38 German divisions, an equal number of satellite divisions, had reduced all German divisions from 9 battalions to 6, had failed to capture the Caucasus oil fields, Moscow, or Leningrad, and had not been able to cut the Murmansk Railway. Over that railway, and by other routes, a growing flood of American supplies was flowing to the Soviet armies. By October 1942, 85,000 trucks had arrived, with the result that the Soviet army, from that date to the end of the war, had greater mobility than the Germans. Luftwaffe forces on the Eastern Front had 2,000 planes in the campaign of 1941, 1,300 at the opening of the campaign of 1942, and could hardly be kept at 1,000 after the end of that campaign. Allied pressure in the West made it necessary to reduce the portion of the German Air Force allotted to the East, with the result that Germany had only 265 operational planes on the Russian front on May 1, 1944. At the same time, American supplies, including planes, flowed into the Soviet Union in an amazing flood. The German U-boats were unable to prevent this flow of goods, although they did sink 77 out of 2,660 vessels loaded with Lend-Lease supplies. Many of these sinkings occurred on the frightful Murmansk route. In 1941 and 1942, the Allies sent the Soviet Union almost 2 million tons of supplies. This was followed by over 4,500,000 tons in 1943, and a total of over 15 million tons, worth $10 billion, before the end of the struggle. Included in the final total were 375,000 trucks, 52,000 jeeps, 7,056 tanks, 6,300 other combat vehicles, 2,328 artillery vehicles, 14,795 aircraft, 8,212 anti-aircraft guns, 1,900 steam locomotives, 66 diesel locomotives, 11,075 railway cars, 415,000 telephones, 3,786,000 vehicle tires, 15 million pairs of military boots, 4,000,000 478,116 tons of food and 2,670,371 tons of petroleum products. In contrast with this, the German armored divisions were kept idle for lack of fuel for weeks at a time, as early as 1942, and both operational and training flights of the Luftwaffe were drastically curtailed from 1942 onward. The lack of fuel was so acute that Hitler decided, late in 1942, to decommission most of the surface vessels of the German Navy. When Grand Admiral Raeder protested too vigorously, he was removed from his position as head of the Navy and replaced by the U-boat specialist Admiral Karl Dönitz in January 1943. All these events should have made it clear that Germany could not possibly win the war. But for the next 2 years, Hitler and his immediate associates became increasingly fanatical, increasingly merciless, and increasingly remote from reality. Anyone who audibly doubted their insane vision of the world was speedily liquidated.